do you feel like doing tonight?
I don't know, Ange. What do you feel like doing?
I don't know. I think we should talk to the guy who made that line so famous. It's part of our vernacular. It's one of the most quoted lines in Hollywood. He is Ernest Borgnine. He won an Oscar for that part, Marty. He has written about it and his appearances in almost 200 other films in his book called Ernie, the Autobiography. Many of those films, for example, there's The Wild Bunch, there's The Dirty Dozen, there's From Here to Eternity, in which he kills Frank Sinatra. We'll get to that in a little bit. Closer to the Present, The Poseidon Adventure, Escape from New York. Then on TV, of course, there's McHale's Navy, which made him a household name. These days, your kids probably know him as the voice of – who is it on SpongeBob SquarePants? What's your character's name?
The ancient man.
We'll get to that. And then, of course, there's his marriage, however brief, to Ethel Merman. So it's all in the book, published by Citadel
Press.
Oh,
that too, yes.
Thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thank you very much.
I'm Dino Scherfili.
And remember, Ernie's the name.
Ernie is what everybody calls you.
That's it.
So – according to your publicist, 2008 is the year in which you want to crack the 200 mark. You've made 198 movies for...
199. Just finished it about a month ago, called Another Harvest Moon.
Uh-huh.
And I tell you, we had a ball. Ann Mirra
was
on it with, along with, what the heck's her name? That lady who played the mother in Raymond, you know?
Oh, she's so Doris...
Doris Roberts.
Roberts, right.
That's it.
So why is it... You're 91, right?
Yeah.
Why is it so important for you to hit this landmark number of 200? What's going to happen then?
There's no landmark. I don't intend to stop at 200.
Uh-huh.
I want to keep going. Matter of fact, I'm going to live... I always made it my point. I'm going to live to 113, and after that, tell them all to go to hell.
What's going to happen then? What's special at 113? Anything?
Nothing. No. Just pass away, you know, become dust.
Got it. So you did not grow up thinking, oh, I'm going to be an actor. I think maybe...
No, heavens no. That was the last thing in my mind. One day I came home after 10 years in the service. I did 6 years before the war and then 4 years during World War II.
In the Navy.
And then I came back and, well... one day my mother says, well, what are you going to do?
Like in Marty.
Yeah. So I went out looking for work and everything else, and I couldn't find anything because I just couldn't see myself in a factory of all places.
Right.
After 10 years out in the open, you know. Well, anyway, I came home one day, and I was pretty disgusted. My mother said, what's the matter? And I said, Mom, for 2 cents, I'm going to go back in and do my other 10 years and get a pension. At least I'll have something. And out of a clear blue sky, she said, have you ever thought of becoming an actor? You always like to make a damn fool of yourself in front of people. Why don't you give it a try?
Isn't it usually the parent who says, do something meaningful with your life and raise a family, become a doctor or a lawyer? We want. What parent says become an actor?
There you go. Nobody. But I think my mother had a hidden ambition. My mother, you see, came from royalty. Her father was...
And you don't mean that figuratively.
No. Mm-hmm. She was a countess in real life. And so she naturally was frowned upon by anybody of royal blood to go on the stage. So she took it out on me. And to me, it was like, you know, falling off a log. I'm sorry.
Easy.
But that's the way I feel, you know. And acting is the easiest thing in the world.
But you did train. You considered going to Yale.
My training was the hard way over at the Barter Theater of Virginia,
right,
where I first started scrubbing flats. You know, flats are the scenery that they use in the play. And one thing led to another, and finally one day they said, didn't you want to act? And I said, yes, I want to act. Okay, come on, we'll give you something. And they gave me something, a walk across, you know. No lines, no nothing, just a walk across. And so I did it, and somebody in the audience liked it, and they said, gee, this guy can act.
What were you doing that got there? Were you hamming it up?
No, I wasn't hamming it up at all. I was playing a union leader in State of the Union. And I got me a Kelly, you know, and a big cigar and a, you know, vest, and I walked across there like I owned the place,
uh-huh,
you know?
Uh-huh.
And the woman said, well, by golly, you know, looking at this man, she said, I was the only man that I really believed in the whole show.
Uh-huh.
So one thing led to another, and the first thing you know, I graduated from the Barter Theater and went up to came up here to New York.
You were on Broadway right away.
Yeah.
Pretty
well,
fast.
No, not Broadway. I was on Broadway before I left the theater.
Yeah, that's a very quick start.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And it was, I guess, a little too much for you, right?
No, no, not at all. I mean, the very first day I went out, I got a job.
Right, but didn't you then turn back and say, you know what, I'm not ready for Broadway. I have to go back home.
Oh,
to
that one. Yeah. That was when I was doing Harvey for Brock Pemberton. He was the producer. And I said to him, when he first asked me, I said, no, I can't go because I'm not ready yet. He said, when would you be ready? I said, about another year. So he waited until the next year, and he said, okay, are you ready? And I said, yes. So I was the only one that went up there from the Barter Theater. Then after about a few performances, a couple of months, I guess, I said, I've got to go back to the Barter Theater. He says, why? I said, because I feel I owed a debt of gratitude to Bob Porterfield, who owned the theater, you know. And he said, what are you, crazy? He said, I'm paying you $150 a week. And what are you going back to? I said, $30 a week and $5 for driving a truck. He said, you're crazy. I said, maybe I am. But I said, you know, in the long run, I feel that my friends will be rewarded and I'll be rewarded as well.
It does seem at first to the rest of us who maybe are jaded that you had a kind of take it or leave it attitude. I mean, you also turned down a contract at Columbia Pictures.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, that was because of my wife. My wife, my first wife, was Jewish, and Harry Cohn was Jewish, and he said, listen, we're going to give you $150 a week and so on, so on, so on. And I said, I'm sorry, sir, but I can't take it because my wife just won't leave New York. He says, what is she, Jewish? And I said, yes, she is, sir. He said, Jews are all alike. They always got to hang together. He said, get out of here. Well, the fella who was in charge of casting said, don't worry, Ernie. He said, something will come up one day, and he said, I'll give you a call, and you can come and work for us again, Columbia Pictures.
Right.
Well, sure enough, one day I'm sitting down to a plate of stew, and the telephone rang, and it said, how soon can you get out here? We want you with a part of Fatso Judson in From Here to Eternity. And I had read the book a couple of months before.
The book was written by James Jones.
James Jones and everything else.
Popular book at the time. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I read it, and I said, knowing there's a God above, I'm going to play that part of Fatso Judson.
Not a likable guy.
No, that's it. That's it. And well, anyway, one day I'm talking to the young fella who is just so wonderful.
Montgomery Clift.
Montgomery Clift, I'm sorry. Montgomery Clift. And suddenly I'm embraced by a couple of great big arms. He says, you're the so-and-so that he said that I wrote about in the book. And it was James Jones himself.
He showed up on the set.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so he was quite satisfied with my work, too, which made me very happy, of course. You know, hey, listen, you know, anything that comes along that's good, thank goodness. No, but I must... Really, it's the hardest thing in the world to try to explain. I started out from scratch. I didn't know where to go, what to do. When my mother said, why don't you be an actor? I didn't know what to do. I had no idea. And 10 years later, Grace Kelly is handing me an Oscar. How do you figure that?
Exactly.
Kind of nutty, isn't it?
Ernest Borgnine, the author of Ernie, the Autobiography, our guest here on the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Dean Olscher, filling in for Leonard today. You were so unready for that you didn't even prepare an Oscar speech. You were convinced you were not going to win the Oscar for Marty.
Right. That's right.
Because you were up against some big guys, right? Spencer Tracy.
Oh, Spencer Tracy, Frank Sinatra, James Dean, and Jimmy Cagney.
Some major actors. And this was your first breakout part for a very atypical movie. This was... A small...
It was something altogether different from what I'd been doing, because before that I'd been stabbing Lee Marvin in the back with a pitchfork. I'd been killing people, you know, and then all kinds of things, you know. But I was a killer.
Yeah.
And said, no, he can't do those kind of things. He's a killer. And Bob Aldrich, the director, said, no, I read the script and I feel that he can do it.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, we'll take a chance. But Little did we know they were actually wanted to make only half the film and then scrap it because they, you know, they wanted to lose it, use it as a tax loss.
It was a loss. Burt Lancaster was one of the producers.
That's right.
So he was a shady guy? Is that what you're saying?
I wouldn't say shady, but hey, listen, anything to make a buck, right?
Well, actually, the way I read it, what I understood was after the fact, once he saw how good the movie was, he grabbed one of his other fellow producers by the lapels and said, this is the movie you wanted to dump? Are you nuts? Is that right? Did I get it right?
That's a fact. That's a fact.
So
and
Marty,
he said, and why didn't you shoot more? He said, they wouldn't let me. And that was Paddy Chayefsky and Delbert Mann.
Right.
The writer and the director. I mean, the writer and the director.
So you would think, after getting the Academy Award for Marty, that this would have opened up every door and that you would have been rolling in dough, and it didn't work out that way, did it?
No. No, my price went up $25,000 up to $100,000, and I was making $100,000 a film, if I could get it. The idea, there was no such thing as $1 million of film, you know, like they have today of making $20 and $30 million per film and own a piece of it to boot. Right. Those boys have pretty fancy agents, I'll tell you. And I had some agents as well, but they run you right down the line, these boys, you know.
They weren't necessarily acting on your behalf.
Not on my behalf, no.
Right. No. I've had my share of agents, too.
I know what you mean. You know what I mean, then.
So while you were shooting Marty, is it true, I find this hard to believe, that the guys driving you around in the Bronx wanted to rough you up because you had killed Frank Sinatra and From Here to Eternity?
That's a fact. That's a fact.
Come
it was
on.
After the very first day of shooting, and I came up that night, and I said hello to the boys, you know, to Delbert Mann and Paddy Chayefsky and all. And I went over and put on my uniform, my costume, and I was walking back and forth outside, running some lines through my head, and suddenly there's a tap on my shoulder. And I turned around, and the fella said, hey, you the guy who killed Frank Sinatra? I said, well, yes, but, you know, it was only a film. He said, what would you want to do that for? And some guy in the back spoke up. He said, let's beat the hell out of him, you know, in Italian. And I said, well, wait a minute. I said, you know, in Italian. I said, I speak Italian, too. Hmm. And I said, remember, we were friends and everything else, but, you know, it's only a picture. Oh, you're Italian descent. Oh, my goodness. They brought me pizza and wine and everything else, and that fella still kept insisting. I still think we ought to beat the devil out of him.
They had to have understood it was a movie. Come on.
No, it's hard. It's hard. A lot of people think that actually I killed Frank Sinatra. I want to tell you something. One day I made a big U-turn on Ventura Boulevard back home in Los Angeles. I had a hot pizza right alongside of me, and I'm heading home. And right behind me came a police car. You can't make a big U-turn like that.
Right.
Okay, so I had my driver's license out and everything else. And the cop took my driver's license, he looked at it, and he looked at me, and he looked at the driver's license. And then he yelled over to his buddy. He said, hey, Joe, guess what? I caught the son of a gun that killed Frank Sinatra and gave me a ticket.
He got you back. What was your favorite role?
That's hard to say. I every day I'm asked that very same question. I suppose people would say Marty, but there were so many other good roles that I had, you know, like The Wild Bunch and... I played the worst son of a gun I've ever played in my life in a man, in a character called Shaq in Emperor of the North with Lee Marvin, where I tried to throw Lee Marvin off the train, you know?
Yeah.
And he threw me off instead.
Which you did without a stuntman, right?
That's it.
Running along the top of a moving train?
Oh, yeah, sure. We did it at 25, 30 miles an hour. And people used to come down. The people used to come down from the real train people, you know, and say, look at these nuts. They're jumping along that train up on top. They don't do that anymore.
Right.
I did it.
I would have thought rear projection at least. No? You know how they do that?
No. Nothing. No, we did it.
Because it was not realistic to do it that way.
Bob Aldrich, who was a wonderful director, and I worked with him in things like The Flight of the Phoenix and The Dirty Dozen. Well, he also directed the one I'm talking about with the train. And I tell you, he wouldn't ask you to do anything that he wouldn't do himself.
Right.
And when he saw me up on top of that train, the very first time he ever saw me was I came up to report for work. And he said, "Hi, Ernie." He said, "How are you?" And I said, "Fine." He said, "There's the train we're going to be working on." I said, "You ever work on a train?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "Well, that's the engine. And down there's the caboose." "Yes, sir." He says, "We will be working from the engine to the caboose to the engine." And he said, "And you will be running on top." I said, "Oh, really?" And he said, "Yes, and go ahead and get dressed." And as I left, he said, "Oh, and remember, you've worked on this train for over 30 years. You do not look down when you're running." I said, "Oh, this man's got to be kidding." So I pulled a Jack Elam, you know, one eye down on the deck. And
he was wall-eyed?
Straight ahead. Absolutely.
You could do that? You're able to separate your eyes like that?
No, not hardly. But Jack was a sweetheart of a man and a wonderful buddy to me. And we were great pals together. And it was wonderful. And I tell you, I always mention him because of the fact that at one time he and Burt Lancaster got into it because Burt Lancaster called him wall-eyed, you know. Mm. Well, I'll tell you how wall-eyed he was. He was the head accountant at one time for 20th Century Fox.
Jack Elam was?
Jack Elam. And they told him that if you don't get away from all these figures, you're going to be going blind.
So they made him an actor.
So he became an actor.
That's funny.
He was looking out of his office window one day, and he said, "Why, heck, I can do what those people are doing. Why not? What the heck?"
I have to say, I've never seen The Wild Bunch because I'm one of those wussies about violence.
And oh, you've got to see
it. I feel
it.
Kind of bad about it because it's so many people's favorite movie, and it was groundbreaking, but...
Yeah. You've got to see it. It's different. It's a different kind of thing. Sure, it's vicious and it's bloody. But I'll tell you something. The director was that kind of a man. He was he knew his West, and he knew doggone right well that when the bullet enters a person, it's got to come out somewhere.
And so, therefore, everybody has to see it.
And everybody has to see it. Why not, you know? And that's what happened, you know? Yeah. But I tell you, he made a tremendous amount they told him, they said, "Hey, you know, you can possibly get the Academy."
For that, yeah.
But he didn't care one way or another. He just made a film, period.
Ernest Borgnine is our guest today on the Leonard Lopate Show. We're going to be back with him after a short break. I'm Dean Ulsher, filling in for Leonard Lopate today here on WNYC. Ernest Borgnine is our guest, and he has a few stories to tell, having been in the business for, well, more than 50 years.
56 years, I guess. Something like that.
He has worked with some of the most fascinating people and has gossip. For example, Steve McQueen. Let's start there.
Oh, Steve. God bless him. One day he came on set. He was looking for his wife at the time, you know.
Allie McGraw.
And he said, "Have you seen Allie?" I said, "No, she's out there somewhere doing a show, you know, doing a couple of scenes." And we started talking, and I had my stuntman with me, Bobby Heron. And he said, "What are you guys doing?" I said, "Well, we've been here for 35 days doing nothing but playing cards." And he said, "Well, who's going to take you back to the hotel?" And I said, "Well, if you don't mind, we'd love to go back with you." We got in the car, and he's smoking a little marijuana, you know, a little weed. And he had three cowboy hats, brand new cowboy hats in the back seat. And we three are fitted up all the way in the front seat. And he's throwing these beer cans back on the...
Not wearing his seatbelt, I'm sure.
Not wearing his, no, what seatbelt? You know? And we were going along about 100 miles an hour down this road outside of Albuquerque.
Oh, man.
I swear to goodness, I'd never been. But the nicest fellow you'd ever want to meet. Unfortunately, I never had the chance to work with him.
Right.
But son of a gun, what I saw was I liked, you know, he was a good guy.
What about Betty Davis?
Oh, Betty Davis was one in a million, you know. It's. I remember as when I was in the service, I was the only, well, I said I was the only, I was sent away for a picture from her, and I kept that picture. And one day I said to her, and I'm making the picture of the catered affair, I said, you know, I have a picture of you that you sent me years and years ago while I was in the service. She said, you're kidding. Mm. I said, no, I'll bring it. I'll bring it in. She said, I was never that young.
Wasn't everybody scared of her?
Well, she knew your lines. She knew her lines. She knew everybody's lines. And you better hustle up and be a good actor. Otherwise, you were out.
Right.
And she made sure of that.
Right.
The very first day we ever did the catered affair, there was a. If you don't mind, I got a little story to tell you.
Sure, we got all the time in the world.
So there was something wrong with the scene that we were doing, and Richard Brooks was the director. And Richard Brooks ate actors alive, you know, for breakfast. I mean, he was that rough. And he made no bones about it either. Well, we're doing this scene, and something's wrong, and something's wrong, and something's wrong. So he says, all right. He said, I got to go back and check the camera. He said, work on this thing. See what you can do. So I said, okay. So as he left, I told Betty Davis, I said, Miss Davis, I think I know what's wrong. It's all a matter of timing. She said, let's try it. And sure enough, it was just a matter of timing, you know, just doing something at a proper time. And he came back and said, all right, let's see what we can do with this scene. And she said, Robert, you weren't watching, were you? I said, why? What's the matter? He said, well, Ernie here figured it out. And he said, God darn thinking actors, you know. And I thought, oh, boy, what do I do to hide? Well, we did the scene, bam, 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 thank you, and off we went. Now, the next scene showed me where I came back from driving my taxi all night long in Cater's Affair. So next scene shows me getting into bed. And he got everybody around. I mean everybody. Dropped the racing sheets, everything. And I was standing on one side of the bed, and he and Betty are standing on the other side, along with the whole company. And he looked at me and he said, all right, Mr. Borgnine, what do you got in mind for this scene? And I don't know what drove me to say this, but I said, you know, it reminds me of a story that I heard a long time ago of this drummer boy, a little salesman, you know, who was walking down these country roads dragging these heavy suitcases. And he finally came to this farmer and he says, please, may I sleep in your barn tonight? No, 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 he said, you'll sleep with my boy. He said, he's got a great big bed and you can sleep with him. You'll have dinner with us. And, oh, thank you so much. Thank you, sir. And they had, sure enough, they had dinner, and he excused himself, went right up to bed. And pretty soon the little boy came up, and he got down on his side of the bed and bowed his head. And everybody's listening, you know, there wasn't a soul moving. And so the fella cocked open one eye, and he said, gee, look at that. I haven't done anything like that in years. So he got down on his side of the bed and bowed his head. And the kid looked up and he said, mister, what you doing? He said, I'm doing the same thing you are, son. See, gee, mom's going to be awful mad. The pot's on this side. And Betty laid out a whoop, and that was the last time I ever had any trouble with Mr. Brooks.
Ernest Borgnine is our guest on the Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Dean Ulsher, filling in for Leonard today on WNYC. What might have been? Well, let's see. You were in Sweet Smell of Success, but they cut you out of it, right?
No, I never did it.
Uh-huh.
I had to go to the head waiter at Club 21 to get my script. And I said, well, what are they trying to pull, you know? And I got the script from the head waiter, and we read the thing, and my publicity man wouldn't let me do it. He said, no, no. He said, come on, we're going to go home. So they put me on suspension. Well, while I was in suspension, I said, well, gee, Willikers, it's getting Christmas. Let me get a job in the Five and Dime. What the heck?
This you was know? Well after everything else that you had done.
Oh, right? after I won Oscar the Academy winner. Award yeah. and everything, you know? And said, no, you can't do that. Oh, my goodness, that'd be below your station, you know? And I said, what station? I'm not working. Well, you know what? You know, and they're taking my life away from me by taking my money, you know, and by taking it. Anyway, it cost me $500,000. What am I talking about? $500,000. Right. That's $500,000.
Yeah, that's right.
I had to pay him back $500,000 before I ever got my contract signed and delivered and get out, and that was it. But I never signed another contract after that because I said, no, no. You know, people will take advantage of you in everything that you possibly do, especially if you make it big. Mm. And it's a shame, really, because all I wanted to do was work. And I had no animosities against anybody, believe me. But suddenly, you know, they get all anxious and, oh, no, you can't do this, you can't do that. I signed up with an agency one time. I didn't work for a year because of the fact that they're looking for that the greatest part in the world. I said, I don't want the greatest part in the world. All I want to do is feed my family.
For sure.
You know?
You read for the part of Don Vito Corleone in The Godfather?
Yeah,
A chance that you were going to get that part?
No. I had Puzo over at my house, along with Jimmy Durante.
Right.
Who was all for me, you know? And Puzo came over, and we had a great big party that night. And I put on the black hat and the whole thing, you know, and I acted out a couple of things for him. And he said, Ernesto, he said, I want to tell you something. And I had only one person in mind when I wrote this script or this book. And he said, and it wasn't you, unfortunately. He said, but I did have Marlon Brando in mind. I said, good luck.
Yeah.
You know. And so, hey, listen, he got a hold of Marlon Brando, and that was it. But Marlon did a good job, you know.
Sure,
but the only time I really believed him was when he was in that tomato patch.
Oh. Well,
then he really sounded like an Italian, you know.
But because even though his name was Italian, he wasn't, right? He wasn't an Italian.
No, he wasn't an Italian, no.
French or something, right?
Something like that, I guess so, yeah.
All right, before time slips away from us, your marriage to Ethel Merman lasted as long as some of your films lasted in the theaters, right?
32 days. Yeah, she was a wonderful lady, and we had a wonderful time being together. And before we decided to get married, you know, it was I come to New York, she came to Los Angeles, and back and forth. And one day I suggested, hey, why don't we get married? We got, you know, hitting it off pretty well. So we said, yeah, let's go. All right, fine. Well, she moved everything over to my house and fixed up everything just exactly like her apartment she had here in New York. And I didn't mind, you know, hey, listen, what the heck. And now we went on a honeymoon trip to Tokyo, Kyoto, Hong Kong, everything. And everywhere we went, everybody recognized me because of McHale's Navy. And nobody knew her. And she got angrier and angrier. And I said, well, I wonder what I'm doing wrong.
Right.
You know? And it finally got to the point where, you know, she just cussed me out and just wouldn't have anything to do with me. And I'm trying to figure out to myself, what did I do? Well, finally, her lawyer told me years later, you know, as to what happened.
And I said, she was upstaged.
Yeah, she was upstaged, I guess. But unfortunately, she was a wonderful lady, and this woman could sing, believe
yes,
me.
Without a microphone.
Even without a microphone, that's right, yeah.
So you mentioned McHale's Navy, which for many of the people my age, I always think of McHale's Navy for those days when I was homesick from school because I'm just young enough that it was on in reruns in the afternoons.
Sure, sure.
And so when I had a cold, that's when I saw McHale's Navy.
Yeah.
And that's how much of America got to know you. Yeah. As it happens, being in the Navy was a huge part of your life.
Well, I did everything in McHale's Navy that I couldn't do in a regular Navy. And the regular Navy said, no, we can't have this. We don't want any part of McHale's Navy, you know. But that happened at the very first year. And that second year, I was invited to go to the to Washington and meet the Secretary of the Navy. And I had lunch with him. And I said, "Why? What do I owe this honor to?" And he said, "Mr. Borgnine," he said, "I want to tell you something. You're the greatest recruiter we've ever had." He said, "People join the Navy, they want to go into McHale's Navy." I said, "Thanks a million. That's wonderful."
Now, in the early days of TV, was it considered less fashionable for actors to do television rather than movies or Broadway?
Oh, I had people say to me, "You know, you won an Academy Award. What are you doing lowering yourself into television?" And I said, "Lowering? What are you talking about? It's all motion pictures, isn't it? It's all television. It's just like motion pictures. And it's all entertainment. What do you want, you know?" And suddenly they all got the idea that, hey, this guy's got something. Because it is. It's true. This is all entertainment. Whether you're on radio, television, motion pictures, makes no difference. As long as you're out there working, man, that's what counts.
It was really interesting to watch Marty again and think about how it had originally been a television program with Rod Steiger. And the film version still captured some of the feel of early television, which in a certain way seems like theater.
Well, I want to tell you something. We shot the whole picture in 14 days, believe it or not.
Practically like theater.
Yeah, just bam, 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 just like television.
Just like television.
Yeah.
Because it was low budget?
Not only low budget, but they also, you know, they only wanted to make half of it, of course, and you know, take their loss. And then when they saw the finished product, then they poured all of $500,000 to publicize it, and bam, the first thing you know, everybody was going Marty crazy, you know?
So we talked about it earlier. You said that was a departure for you in that role, but as movies went, wasn't that also a strange kind of movie for the time? It was a quiet, personal, melancholic movie.
I guess it was.
Not what you typically would see for an
it was altogether different from what I'd been doing, you know?
Right.
But certainly it was something that I could put my teeth into, like real drama, you know. And when I say to my mom, "Mom, I'm just an ugly, ugly man," you know, and bam, end up crying. And so it brought out, believe it or not, I played myself, so it was that easy. Because at one time when I was a kid, I was just that shy, believe it or not.
You don't seem very shy today.
No, I have grown up.
So we talked about the things that might have happened, and I wonder if there's a part that you wish you had gotten that you didn't.
It's crazy kind of a part. I mean, I would have loved to have played the part of Pancho Villa.
Really?
You know? Not that thundering, you know, blundering thing that Wally Beery did at one time. But to play the real guy that was Pancho Villa,
yeah.
A man who didn't know how to write his own name and learned how to write it on a typewriter because a student taught him, you know? And he was that kind of a person. He was a womanizer, and yet he paid attention to what his wife wanted him, you know, to do. And he was the kind of a person that I thought would make a heck of a good motion picture at one time. Yeah.
So it's not too late.
Hey,
well, trying to get that 200th picture, right?
I'm only 91. What the heck?
How old did he live to be?
I have no idea. I've forgotten now. But
Pancho Villa, the later years.
Yeah, he was killed. You know, they murdered him. Yeah.
Right.
But it was. I tell you, my whole life has been one of adventure. I say adventure in the sense that. I started out as a young boy being taken to Italy, and I saw all the people in Italy. When I came back, I couldn't speak a word of English. And I came back, and boom, the first thing you know, I was doing things in school, and then later on I got joined the Navy and went around, did all the things in the Navy, and then I got into motion pictures and everything else. And here I've been a pilot and submariner and submariner and everything you can possibly imagine. And bam, you know, I've lived a life. It's been wonderful.
And it goes on for another, wait, let's see, 113 plus 9. So it's going to be another 20.
Years.
You got 22 more years to go.
Yeah, 22 more years.
All right. Well, the first 91 years are recounted in the book Ernie, the Autobiography by Ernest Borgnine. Yeah. He is promoting it by going around. He'll be speaking and signing books on Thursday night at 7:30 at the Lincoln Square Barnes & Noble. And that's on Broadway at 66th Street. And for more information about that, you can visit our show page at WNYC.org. We have about 30 seconds left. What's going to be your 200th picture? Do you have any thoughts or feelings about that?
No, not at all. But they've already called me to see if I want to make a Western. And I said, sure, why not? You know, and I'm at the stage now, you know, when they say, bring in the horse, I said, bring in the ladder, too.
Ernest Borgnine, it's been a real pleasure to have you. Thanks so much for being here today.
It's been my pleasure, extreme pleasure. Thank you.
As I mentioned, it's called Ernie, the Autobiography, written by Ernest Borgnine, and I'm Dean Olscher, filling in for Leonard Lopate today here on WNYC.